Okay, I open up the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We will not be here having the work session on House Bill 2163 today. I know at least one person had been here for that. Anybody else? I apologize. We have an amendment coming which will make it a really wonderful bill. So we're going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 3332.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3332 appropriates funds from the general fund for costs for crisis intervention services and residential care for individuals with mental illness. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to seek out and apply for funds to support crisis intervention services and residential care for individuals with mental illness.
That's great.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have several people here to testify. Chris Bonas, Ken Milner, and Clarissa McGee. Thank you for coming today.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm here representing the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. It seems like I just saw you Friday afternoon,
right.
So it must be appropriate to be here Monday afternoon. I hope everybody had a good weekend.
Madam Chair, I would just be curious if you went home.
Had to change. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 3332, which in practical purposes, what it does is it creates a special investment fund into which that would help promote construction of new housing, permanent housing across our state, and using the term housing in the broadest sense of the definition for individuals living and affected by mental illness. This is legislation or a concept that we proposed after a series of meetings trying to figure out as the state moved through health transformation, as we're at this moment in time when a lot of change is happening and a lot of change is possible, and after years of feeling as an organization all we did was scream and holler about trying to keep things the way they were. The time was right to be proactive and offer something that we felt was going to improve our community mental health care system. We did want something that enhanced the process that's underway. Certainly integration is a huge deal right now. The CCOs and our local mental health authorities are undergoing community planning and community needs assessments, and soon we're going to have those assessments back and we're going to see what each of our communities needs. We also wanted something that was going to essentially help the state of Oregon meet its legal obligations in its agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Back in November, the state of Oregon entered into an agreement with the federal government, which essentially pledged the state's commitment to improve our community mental health care system, especially around the issue of housing and making sure that individuals with serious mental illness and persistent mental illness were not warehoused in institutions, were not warehouse in our jails and prisons, that in fact we had the resources available to treat people in a least restrictive setting that was reasonable and possible in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. With all this in mind, we brought together a group of stakeholders to have a conversation. They included representatives from CCOs, from some of our major hospital systems. They included representatives with our residential providers, and certainly included a lot of representatives from NAMI. We're the ones that live this every day, and we wanted to bring our expertise to the table. And in short, our conversation quickly settled on housing. When we talked to the hospital systems, the behavioral health leaders said that we have people backing up in our ERs and our psychiatric wards, and they're there for much longer than is necessary or prudent because we can't get access to longer-term care that they might need, such as the Oregon State Hospital or some of our subacute treatment centers around the state. You talk to your residential providers who do that business, or talk to folks at the Oregon State Hospital, people are staying there longer than necessary, well, longer than when they're deemed ready to discharge. The reason is that there are not step-down placements available to put people in for the type of residential housing or residential treatment they need. Well, you talk to residential treatment providers, and they can't get people out of residential treatment because there wasn't the type of supported, semi-independent, and independent housing that was available. You talk to people, and you may hear later from law enforcement, you talk to people in law enforcement, and we're putting people in our county jails for the simple reason is law enforcement has nowhere else to take some people. By virtue of their mental illness, they've come into contact with law enforcement, and there is no alternatives. And so during these conversations, it quickly centered around housing. As a group, we recognize that each region will have a different need. Some regions have more robust access to residential treatment. Some regions have more robust access to supported housing. So the regional needs were going to be vastly different. So we didn't want to dictate what type of housing and where housing should go. What we wanted to do is create an environment in which people could apply for funds to build permanent housing that was necessary in their community. We also wanted something that met modern realities. In the past, the state built and manage all of our residential housing resources. So if you wanted to access residential housing, you were referred to the state of Oregon. And the state of Oregon could take someone, say, from eastern Oregon and send them down to southern Oregon by virtue of there's just a bed available. We recognize that in our new system would probably mirror very closely to the reforms that we did in our children's mental health care system, where once CCOs are now responsible for managing residential resources and those treatment resources, they were going to want those resources actually in their communities. And that's what we saw in the transformation in the children's system, where we used to send children all across the state for various things. We actually more and more treat children in our communities and have built those resources in our communities. And a CCO, by the metrics they're going to be held accountable to, timeliness to care, making sure people are in and out of more expensive levels of care, back in their community, thriving in there, we're going to dictate that the resources that we're talking about or we're going to be talking about needed to be available in local communities. The other thing we realized is that the old model of the state being asked to pay full freight for construction of any housing was not sustainable. What we wanted to do is be able, in these kind of days of austerity, when we're talking about leveraging investments in state dollars, we wanted something that was going to attract additional financing so that communities had some buy-in into the resources being developed. And that's, in a sense, how we got to House Bill 3332, because with all that conversation, we went back and said to the people who would build these things and operate these things, what would it take to build housing? And housing, again, in the broadest definition. It could be a respite center. It could be crisis. It could be independent housing. It could be supportive housing. We wanted the broadest definition of housing. What would it take to build that? Any of them. And their answer was pretty simple to us. You give us 20%, and we can find the other 80% of financing. And so that's where you have House Bill 3332. You have a fund that is designed to make an investment in a project where that $1 investment will generate four additional dollars in outside investment. It could be conventional financing. It could be federal dollars. It could be additional state affordable housing dollars. It could come from anywhere else, but if we make that investment in the mental health dollar, it will attract that other $4. The other feature about this fund is that when a new facility comes online, there is a short period of time where they can't bill Medicaid and Medicare, where there are certain startup costs, such as buying fixtures or doing staff training, that are not reimbursable. This would provide some bridge funding, up to 50% of that bridge funding, that would get a facility down the road a couple of months till it starts billing Medicaid and Medicare. An example we use in this is that with one of the residential providers, we say, well, what is it, what would that, how much is that? And they said, well, the 16-bed facility, what we're talking about is approximately $200,000. So the fund could fund half of that or up to $100,000 to help that 2 to 3 month bridge before a facility is able to bill. This fund also anticipates Medicaid expansion in that we're talking about the type of facilities, we're talking about building permanent infrastructure. The question is, well, then how do you pay for the services in that? Well, the services provided in these type of facilities and in, in this type of housing are billable to Medicaid and Medicare. In 2014, we're about to take a lot of adults who right now are non-Medicaid, who are paid exclusively through state general funds, and they're going to join our Medicaid plan. And suddenly, the services that they had been receiving through state general funds are now primarily paid through a match of the federal government. And so we anticipate an influx of demand, so to speak, into the system, and this type of housing is designed to meet that demand. We also believe that this is going to help the state of Oregon meet its obligations to the federal government. Again, in the agreement signed in November, housing and all types of housing, it's going to be one of the key metrics that the federal government's following. And it's not just what type of housing you have, but where are people staying and are they improved? Is their housing status improved? So if they are, say, in a long-term hospital setting, are they moving down through to more independent housing? And we have, just like the CCOs have about 2 years to cut the cost of care, we have fewer than 4 years to show the federal government we've made improvements in things like housing for adults with mental illness. In conclusion, I kind of feel like I'm in an unexpected position because this all started with conversations with people who I respect and I thought were pretty smart. And then we came down and crunched numbers, went back and forth, and we came up with a concept that really is not that difficult to articulate nor to understand. And suddenly it ballooned. I mean, we have organizations that have submitted or will be submitting testimony in favor of this. We have Central City Concern. We have Providence. We have St. Charles, Central Oregon Health Council, GOBI, some of my fellow advocacy organizations I work with. We Can Do Better, Elders in Action. We have law enforcement. We have providers in our system. We have represented the users of the system here with NAMI. The other day, I got a phone call from the folks in affordable housing. They're on the verge of going through a huge transformation process, and they're calling me saying, you know, this could be a potential model for where we move to as affordable housing changes in this state. And so you begin to feel like your little concept, you might have been onto something when people start coming out and saying, you know, this looks like a good idea. More importantly for me is that it's within NAMI this enjoys wide support. We know firsthand how important housing is, how it really is the cornerstone to reach recovery, and it's the cornerstone to maintain recovery, and we have two examples of that here in a moment. We really see this as a simple solution that is worthy of this moment in time when Oregon is undergoing all this significant change. And we think this will be enhance that change and help us on the road to success as we integrate mental health with medical health. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris, for coming. Any questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chris, I'm sorry I missed the beginning. I was testifying in another committee, so you may have answered this. But who would own the housing, and what are some of the sources of that 80%? I think of that. It sounds like you're pretty sure you can get it, but it's so. It's a big
yeah. Gap. So we'll have some representatives from providers who build this who can speak a little more about where the 80% comes from. Certainly, it's conventional financing. It's other types of housing streams. There's people much smarter than me that can better answer that question. Who owns the housing? Typically, it's owned by the provider offering the housing. And some of the housing will be licensed, and so it will not be permanent housing. Some of it will be the type of supportive, independent, permanent-type housing where it's more landlord-tenant with services wrapped in there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, there's sounds good. I've known about 18-unit housing and how that pencils, 16-bed centers, and how that gets us some federal money and things like that from Mrs. Henderson in Central Oregon for a long time. Is there anything in the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget for mental health or for this program?
Not for this program, no. I mean, there is in the high-level summary of the governor's budget for mental health, there are pots of money sitting there that are undesignated with the type of vague description that gives a lot of discretion as to how those funds could be applied. So, for example, the governor's budget anticipates a $45 million savings with Medicaid expansion, but does not, and wants to put that money back in the system, but does not dedicate that $45 million to any type of service or infrastructure.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
So you're saying that the governor's budget had $45 million dedicated to mental health. Co-chair's budget has nothing dedicated.
The co-chair's budget does. I do not know the co-chair's budget to the level of detail to really accurately answer that question.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, Chris. Go
ahead. Representative Tomei, my name is Clarissa McGee, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today in support of House Bill 3332. For the creation of Housing Development Fund. I'm a parent of six children, several of them with mental health issues. Two of my children have what is considered to be severe and persistent mental illness. Such labels as bipolar, attention deficit, post-traumatic stress disorder, major depression with psychotic features, and even autism spectrum disorder have been given. My daughter's first hospitalization came at the age of 8. When the voices she was hearing told her to stand in the middle of traffic and get hit by a car. She has since been hospitalized 7 more times in the space of 7 years. 2 of those years were spent in residential treatment. She is now 14 and currently lives in treatment foster care. My son has been hospitalized 4 times and in residential treatment as well as treatment foster care. He is now 13 and is living at home. The last 7 years has been a rough and tumultuous time in our lives. As I look forward to the future, I wonder what kind of lives will they lead? The statistics show that the odds are stacked against them. As parents, we are preparing our teenagers to transition out of the home, to get a job, to graduate, to drive, and eventually move out on their own, to one day have a home of their own. That is the dream of every parent, one that most parents will see come to fruition, that and more. I understand that children like mine will need professional support to be able to accomplish the same thing that others their age will do with ease. They will need that support to become productive members of society. Both of my children are very intelligent, compassionate, and talented in their own unique ways. They have dreams they want to achieve in life that start with their desire to live independently like their peers. With the stability and help that supported housing provides, they will be able to one day lead productive lives and in all probability reach out and give back to others just like them. House Bill 3332 isn't just about today. We need to be thinking long term. This bill is something that will have an impact on their future. I am looking forward to their adulthood. I, as every parent, want my children to be a success, whatever that success may look like. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from this witness? Thank you. That's a difficult story to share. We appreciate you coming.
Hello, Representative Tomei. My name is Ken Milner. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony today in support of House Bill 332 for the creation of the House Development Fund. I was attending college in the late 80s working toward a degree in social work when I was first diagnosed with bipolar and major depression. I was attending school full-time and working part-time and renting a room when my first episode hit my life. My life imploded at this point. I had no will, I had no motivation, I quit school, I lost my job and my place to live due to this illness. All I had left was my car and my clothes. My father drove across many states to come and get me and take me back home. This started a pattern that was repeated many times over the next 20 years. And there's various reasons for this. In the year 2000, fast forwarding, I was living again in my car, and I was so distraught that I was only eating raw potatoes and fruit for more than 3 weeks. Another major episode of bipolar. I would go to the library and use the internet to try to find a place to live and help. I found Sequoia, which is a mental health clinic in Washington County, then called Home Street. They had a program for homeless adult males living with mental illness. I lived in a group home for 1 year. I received case management and treatment through them. I was able to find a job. My case manager started paperwork, what's known as Shelter Plus Care, a housing program. And after a year, I was able to get into this program. I started looking for my own apartment and found a flyer for co-housing named Trillium Hollow Co-op, a very unique, intentional community. I got approved and I was able to move into my own home. But it wasn't just a place to live. It was a community where I was seen and heard. There were people there I could share a meal with. There were opportunities to volunteer and share in the community. I could no longer hide behind my illness. I was in a safe, dependable, reliable, mature environment. My self-esteem grew. My confidence grew. I was able to develop a natural support network. I was able to come to terms with being a trauma victim and understand that I was now a survivor of this illness. Because of housing help I received, I was able to seek out therapy and get connected with help that was appropriate. Eventually, I got a better job. I now have been employed there for 4 years. I've been a volunteer for 2 years as a paraprofessional for NAMI. I'm a peer advocate and a support group facilitator for a bipolar depression support group, giving back to my community. I have further plans to transition to a family-to-family teacher for NAMI as well, a more specific program for caregivers of people with mental illness. I plan on returning to college in the fall to complete my degree in social work, which I began 20 years ago. I'm now paying attention to my physical health. I've even started dating. I feel like a member of society, and I have things in my life that are meaningful. I now feel safe and secure that my base of a house is stable. Having housing and treatment has been key to that. I have found a solid footing and overcome the devastation of depression, and I was able to find my way out of dysfunction. Housing has made that difference.
Thank you, Kenneth. Mm-hmm. Thanks for coming to share your story with us, and it sounds like you have a happy ending. We're happy mm-hmm. for you. Thank you. Any questions of this person who's come to testify? Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.
Now we hear from Chris Hoy. Chris, where is Chris? There he is. Good. And Cheryl Ramirez. Oh, and Kevin McChesney. Go ahead.
I believe I'm going last.
You're going last. That's fine. Whoever's first.
I'll go first, okay. If that's all right. Yes, go. Chair Tomei and the rest of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 3332. My name's Kevin McChesney, and I'm the current president of the Oregon Residential Providers Association, otherwise known as ORPA. And we were one of the organizations that collaborated with NAMI on the creation of this bill. And it would be difficult for me to understate the need for continued investment in housing and residential services in the state of Oregon, particularly the housing that Chris talked about, which is really not structured residential, but supported housing, where people can live in their own apartments or their own rooms and have appropriate services provided to them at that location. That really does speak to the most appropriate way to provide services to people in the community, and it's also very much supported by the DOJ settlement and also the Americans with Disabilities Act. One of the things that ORPA likes about this particular legislation is the fact that it does have the opportunity to leverage private dollars in the creation of new housing for individuals. So in partial answer to your earlier question, actually, private investors are actually willing to invest in new development and can actually, with a long-term lease back to the provider, actually can make a decent return on their investment and are willing and able to help build these properties. So that's definitely a possibility under this bill. The other thing that appealed to us was really the idea that we continue as providers to collaborate with stakeholders and also with AMH on the development of new projects and the location of those projects, the scope of those projects. So this bill contains language that continues that relationship and provides the opportunity for all of us to sit at a table and to look at the needs of individuals based on where they live in the state and to help to make decisions about where these types of developments should be located.
Thank you very much. Kevin, any questions? I have a question. So one of the issues that we come across is siting places. Has that been a difficult issue for you?
Sometimes. I can't say that it's always an easy thing. I think certainly there are opportunities for more education for communities and the public around the issues of siting. And, you know, really, you have to take those on a case-by-case basis, and it depends on the community. It depends on the type of program that you're planning on placing, and it really depends on how you deliver that message to the community.
And this classification of folks would be affected by the ADA, right? Is that probably Representative Gelser knows that better than I. So even if there were some objections in the community, by law, they can be.
That's correct.
Protected.
Yeah, many of these types of facilities are protected by the Federal Fair Housing Act from outright discrimination. One of the nice things really about supported housing is the fact that it's really more like mainstream housing in the sense that somebody's living in an apartment and you're providing some additional services to them. So the it somewhat lessens the impact on the local community as well.
Representative Gallegos.
I do have a question. I'm just curious. I spent a number of years as a corporate officer with Caritas, the Catholic Charities Housing Corporation. And I'm just curious, you know, we've had discussions with housing authority and so on. So I hope that at some point we might get to learn how this intersects with some of the housing discussions that we've had, and particularly around the funding mechanisms and so on. So.
It's a great idea. And speaking of that, one of my favorite places that I visited some time ago was a former convent, I think in the Irvington, in a nice area in northeast Portland that had been a convent, was no longer used as a convent for the school that was there. And
it's now
become housing for, I think, people who've left the state hospital.
Right.
And very well received in the neighborhood. Beautiful facility. Somebody... Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The people you're able to help provide this housing to, is there a percentage of them you're getting some out of corrections and parole? And the follow-on to that, you're talking about, do you help them maintain or get their drugs or get on Oregon health plans? I think that's a real problem in my talk and conversations with people with mental illness. that being sure they get the drugs, take their medication, and it's a real problem when you're coming out of corrections. I've been working on trying to be sure that they come out with 3 months. They don't come out with 3 months. It takes them 3 months to get on the Oregon Health Plan. Is that still a problem in the system?
Actually, right now, yes, that's a problem regardless of whether somebody's coming out of corrections or not. You know, again, we're significantly underfunded in the arena of behavioral health, and there's a very large indigent population, and frankly, providers right now don't have the infrastructure to provide appointments as rapidly, particularly those prescriber appointments that you refer to. And so there are very often gaps in services between the time that somebody goes from a structured facility to the time that they can have an intake and an outpatient program. So that that continues to be an issue. I can't speak to the fact that it's more significant or not with people coming out of the correction system.
But you are, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
But you are having some of the people using your facilities are coming out of corrections. Is that true or not?
Personally, none of the facilities that I deal with. I do, the company that I work for does operate some secure facilities that house people under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, but nobody that specifically comes from corrections. That being said, there are many people with mental illness because of the lack of services that end up with criminal histories and certainly have criminal histories in their past.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Ramirez. I'm with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I am providing testimony in support of House Bill 3332 on behalf of our membership, which includes community mental health program directors and county-based health and human services directors. We support the investment in infrastructure development for subacute residential care and community-based housing, crisis intervention services, rental subsidies, and other housing-related services for individuals with mental illness. Investment in community-based housing is one of the key indicators for preventing individuals with mental illness from entering institutional care and from incarceration. Based on some national prevalence statistics of adults with serious mental illness at 5.8% or 280 million nationally, and applying those national percentages to Oregon, about 40% of adults with SMI live with a family member, another 8% are in jails or prisons, 3% are in inpatient care, and 3% are homeless. So the rest, estimated at 46%, should be in cooperative apartments, group homes, and other supportive housing arrangements in communities funded through federal Section 8 housing, state and local resources, and private entities. It's difficult to assess, though, with this portion of individuals who are inappropriately or inadequately housed. So as Chris mentioned, housing is a key component of the state of Oregon's compliance with the integration mandate of Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Olmstead as directed in the U.S. DOJ agreement requirements. So I wanted to just read right from the agreement four of the housing indicators that the U.S. DOJ is expecting us to comply with. Number one, number of available housing units for individuals with SPMI. So they're expecting us to show improvement in the number of those housing units.
And tell us what those numbers and letters mean, please.
SPMI is serious and persistent mental illness.
Thank you.
Two, the number of adults with SPMI and percent of all service dollars spent on adults who reside in their own houses, supported and supportive housing, adult foster homes, residential treatment facilities, residential treatment homes, and secure residential treatment facilities. Number three, number of adults with SPMI who moved from institutional care to independent supported housing. And four, an improvement in the ability to provide access to adequate housing measured by number of adults with SPMI living in the settings that I previously listed. Many of us in the mental health community were interviewed by the USDOJ last week on the progress that Oregon is making on these improvements. And the first report to the USDOJ is actually due on April 1st. So, and they will be getting quarterly reports from the state of Oregon for 4 years. So in addition, we support the approach of this bill to finance housing projects through various funding sources. Counties are all about blending funding and have a long history of braiding local, federal, and state dollars to create and maintain critical programs and services in the community. We're also pleased to be included as a stakeholder in the work group that will advise the Oregon Health Authority in developing and prioritizing the list of housing projects. So I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill.
Cheryl, have you provided written testimony?
I did not, but I'd be glad to.
Would you please?
Okay, sure.
And I want to talk with us a little bit more about the USDOJ and why they were involved. Have you been with the state for us very long?
About a year and a half.
Okay. Do you remember the history of the DOJ getting involved with the Oregon State Hospital and our mental health services?
I've heard of that.
Can you sort of give us a brief synopsis of that involvement as much as you know?
Well, I can tell you why we settled on this particular agreement. I'm not sure if I can tell you the exact history, and maybe some of these guys who have been here longer can do that. But the basic goal is to make sure that individuals are in appropriate settings for their care. And so what we don't want is that many people in institutional care, or and including being incarcerated. So those are for the people who just absolutely need that level of care. But most people should be in the community in different settings. And I named several different housing situations when I was talking about the USDOJ agreement. Some people are in residential treatment facilities that house several people, and they're under 24-hour care, and others are, and what we hope is that people will eventually be able to go down to being in apartments or homes on their own individually, so it's kind of a step-down process. So what the USDOJ agreed to do as they were seeing Oregon begin its huge healthcare transformation, primarily through coordinated care organizations, is let that process take place and just put in these requirements from USDOJ. And there are many requirements. I just gave you four. There are 111 metrics for this. So what their hope is, their faith in Oregon is for us to be able to accomplish these the improvements in settings for individuals with serious and persistent mental illness through the coordinated care organizations. And so they're watching that process carefully unfold. So that's really the hope, is to, instead of sue us, then they will watch and see that if this works out with our health reform, but they will be monitoring us by our reporting of this.
Right. So luckily, my great administrator here had this information. Kripa Olmsted, the transformation of the Oregon Psychiatric Secure Review Board. So in 2006, the United States Department of Justice, operating through its Civil Rights Division, notified the governor of Oregon that it was initiating an investigation of the Oregon State Hospital pursuant to the Civil Rights Institutionalized Persons Act, which is CRIPA. And the state hospital, obviously, is the largest mental health hospital. So this is very serious, and we will make sure that all of you get this. They came to look at the hospital. And so since that time, the state of Oregon has built a new hospital here in Salem. Another hospital will be built, apparently, in Junction City. And now their main concern, as I've heard secondhand, and I'm hoping perhaps we can bring either somebody in from the DOJ or somebody to give us more specific information, is, as Cheryl was mentioning, now they're looking at, now that we've got a good state hospital that meets all the requirements, now they're looking to make sure that we're going to be providing what people have been talking about today, services for people both to keep them out of the hospital and to get them out of the hospital. So that's where we are right now. And so, as has been stated earlier, we don't have sufficient housing for people to leave the hospital. We have 30 people in the hospital who are prepared to leave, who have been okayed to leave. We have no places for them to go. As the previous director of the mental health division had stated, we need people to have the keys to their own doors. So we need to flow people from the state hospital. People go to the hospital to get well. They do not go there to live. We need to have people in the state hospital. Only those are the most critical position. And then we need to move them out as quickly as possible into very supportive housing with treatment, et cetera. And then going down step by step till they can be where they can have their own home with the key to the door and with supportive, certainly wraparound supports. So this is very important, folks. We need to be doing this. We need to be providing the funding. As was stated earlier, I think it was Chris or somebody was talking about, in the governor's budget, there is indeed $45 million for mental health. We need to make sure that funding is going where it can do the most good, where we can get support from the community and find other funding that's going to be increasing the funding that we put in. And it needs to be very specific, and it needs, what's the word I'm looking for? Correctly placed.
Targeted.
Targeted, thank you. It needs to be targeted. And that's one of our chief responsibilities in this committee is to hear this testimony. And then we need to be going to the Ways and Means Committee for Health and Human Services to make sure that there's going to be funding for this housing. Because I'm anxious to see what the DOJ says on April 1st, which is just a week away, because I think they're not going to give us a great mark that we're moving where we need to be with community mental health services. So thank you, Regina. We'll make sure that everybody gets this. Thank you for your testimony. And thank you, Cheryl, that I sort of jumped in on your testimony.
I'm finished. Thank you.
Thank you. And we would like to have your written
we'll be glad
information.
To.
Great. And Chris, does that provide a segue for you?
I think so. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, my name is Chris Hoy. I'm a captain with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office and the Director of Community Corrections. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 3332. In considering this bill, I appreciate that this concept brings an innovative approach to a problem that impacts so many of us. It brings in private funding, engages the community, and hopefully will help reduce stigma. The issue of services and housing for people with mental illness is one that is near and dear to my heart, and I speak from both a personal and professional perspective on this issue today. Many years ago, when I was a freshman across the street at Willamette University, my mother developed the need for mental health services. Unfortunately, at that time, in the small coastal town I grew up in, there were virtually no services available. Her situation grew dire, and her need grew so great, she was soon hospitalized at Damish Hospital, and not long thereafter at the Oregon State Hospital. I remember the stigma of mental illness was so overwhelming that I would sneak away from my dorm at Willamette to visit her at the hospital. My friends and professors did not know where I was going. I was too embarrassed to tell anyone. Those visits were awful. She did not need to be at the hospital, but there were no other alternatives for her at the time. Sadly, she never left the hospital and died as a patient there. After graduating from Willamette,
can you hand me a Kleenex,
yes,
please?
Oh,
it's right down there.
Oh, sure.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, no problem.
Sorry. After graduating from Willamette, I was lucky enough to begin my career with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. During that time, I worked primarily in the jail, where I observed so many people with mental illness getting arrested for minor charges because the local law enforcement had no other options available to deal with a person needing services but not warranting hospitalization. While working in the evenings in the middle of the night, we often had people who would come to the jail and ask us to be booked in just so they could have a place to stay out of the wind and rain. Many of these people were mentally ill. There were just no housing options available for people in this situation. Now, almost 25 years later, I still see similar issues. Many of our 3,500 community corrections clients in Clackamas County are mentally ill. I have one parole and probation officer whose only job is to supervise seriously mentally ill clients, and I could use five more just like her. I have another PO who spends part of her time supervising mental health court, but it's not enough. My colleagues around the state have even fewer resources available. We do have housing and community support in Clackamas, and we have a great relationship with our community health partners, mental health partners, but we need more. 2 years ago, we opened a 14-bed transition house for men with mental illness releasing from the Clackamas County Jail or from prison. And we recently dedicated four beds for women in our women's center for mentally ill women needing transition services. But treatment services are often scarce and not readily available despite our system's best efforts. We need more resources to help us accomplish what we know works. We know that people with mental illness often struggle in traditional settings. This bill will help with that. We know that people with mental illness are more likely to intersect with the criminal justice system when they do not have adequate community support. I see it every day. We know that but for their mental illness, they would not come to the attention of police and they would not go to jail. We know that people with mental illness sometimes receive critical stabilization services in jail, but more often actually experience a degradation of their mental health while there. And we know that when a person with mental illness is in jail, they spend far more time than a person without a mental illness would on similar charges. We know that. People with mental illness stay in jail longer. This bill would help with that. Last year, over 14,000 people were booked into the Clackamas County Jail. Of those, almost 2,000, or 14%, received psychotropic medication, and over 400 were placed on suicide watch. I am told by our jail commander that the number of severely mentally ill people in jail approaches 20% of the population, and the percentage of those with some form of mental illness is over 50, and possibly as high as 75%. In addition, almost 7,500 individuals in the Clackamas County Jail were placed on substance abuse withdrawal protocol last year. That number was staggering to me when he told me. 7,500 out of 14,000. I'm a jail commander in my career, and that number blew me away. We've come a long way in Oregon, whether it's the implementation of crisis intervention training, increased academy training for law enforcement and working with individuals with mental illness, suspension of benefits rather than termination of benefits upon incarceration, or the building of a new state hospital. But we need to do more. Jail beds are at a premium. This bill will help keep people with mental illness out of jail, allowing precious beds to be utilized for those who truly need incarceration. When I think back to my mother's situation, after almost 25 years in the corrections business, I know full well that she could have very easily found herself intersecting with the criminal justice system instead of the mental health system. Sadly, so many families find themselves in that very situation. I urge you to support this bill and prevent that tragedy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions?
If I could answer a question of Representative Wisnett earlier, we actually are seeing the Department of Corrections supply a 90-day supply of medications when people are getting out there. They've made great strides in that, and we're seeing that pretty consistently.
Good.
So that's been a huge improvement.
Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who would be the best person to talk a little bit more about what at the beginning of the sheriff's testimony about how this bill leverages private money?
I would imagine Kevin.
I'd just be interested in unpacking that a little bit more. I was quite taken by the chair's plea for us to get behind this and get it down to Ways and Means, which is always a policy committee's challenge, just to put the right spin on it so they listen. But I'm also intrigued by if we can sell them on the investment, where are the funds nationally, regionally, statewide that would provide the housing we're talking about?
I've worked with a broker in the past, and they're actually able to line up either private investors with tax credits to use, or they can also be nonprofit agencies whose mission is to provide housing. And typically, they will provide the construction financing, and then it's a turnkey, essentially. They'll build the facility to the specifications of the provider. They will then turn around at the end of the construction process and lease the building back. And generally speaking, they get about a 12% return on their investment over a 10 to 15 year lease. And then depending on whether or not the state puts any money up, so if it is the other 20% comes from the state, they're going to need a second trust deed that will guarantee the use of the property for a period of 30 years in exchange for that funding.
Okay, one follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow-up.
So the tax credit issue is key. That's where we come in. Without it, are there avenues, without this bill, are there avenues, and I'm not talking about either or, this bill or not, but I'm saying in addition to both and, what are the avenues we have without the leverage of this bill?
Oh.
In your opinion, anyway.
It would really depend on the size of the provider. I mean, I can't tell you that there are some providers that have the capacity to fund the construction process and to do all of that, but they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. So many of them are small not-for-profits and really wouldn't have the capacity to provide that sort of funding, nor would they be able to get a loan for it.
Thank you.
Question. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Madam Chair, is there a ballpark figure that's being requested for this bill?
We do have a fiscal you have that in front of you. Oh, here it is. Fiscal impact of proposed legislation. appropriates an unspecified, do you want me to read it now? An unspecified amount of general fund, la 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 la. So theoretically, there would be a person that would require the OHA to convene a work group to advise the authority. And so it would be apparently funding a position, an operations of policy analyst too. Do they have this? Do they have it?
They should, yes.
Yeah, you should all have it in your packet, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, could you glance at that? Yes,
one more question, follow-up. So that would be for setting up the program and the advisory committee, but I'm assuming that there's some idea about how the funding that you want, and I see Chris nodding, to start off the seed fund, $2 million, to something as the start of the fund. That's what I'm wondering what the conversation has been.
Okay. Do anything more for this panel, I think. Chris Bonoff is wanting to come up for this. Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing our story with us, Chris. It's always good to see you.
Good
thank
see you.
Representative, very quickly, we left that blank for a purpose, which was any amount we'll be able to leverage.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to necessarily dictate an amount. If you ask NAMI, we certainly would like to see at least the same amount that was taken out of the Community Mental Health Housing Trust Fund returned back to housing, and that is in the neighborhood of around $6 million.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
From the closing of Damish, right? Anything further? Just left. Okay. I'm going to close. Pardon? Okay, I'm just going to close. There's nobody else to testify on this, right? I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3332, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3332. Normally, it's my practice not to have a work session right away. I think we've had some very compelling testimony.
we would be sending it to Ways and Means. They would be making the final decision. And at this point, if this bill is in Ways and Means, when we hear what from the DOJ on April 1st, it will be there, so they will have a bill that they can be talking about and working on in Ways and Means. I think that will be addressing some of the concerns that the Department of Justice has. Do you need me to take a recess, or is this something you... Okay, looks like people are ready. I'm going to wait, however, for Representative Gilliam.
I'm going to see where he's at.
Okay, thanks. We'll stand at ease for just a minute. On House Bill 3332, and
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think everything that since we recessed is off the record completely. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay, good. Well, thank you for your comments on 3332. I'd like to move that House Bill 3332 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 3332 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Nice job, you guys. Seeing none, would you please call the roll, Debbie?
Yes.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Whitman?
Aye.
Representative
Whitman?
Excused.
Mr. Gomberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
And Chair Tomei?
Aye. The measure passes, and it goes to Ways and Means, and we close the work session, and great job, you guys. Thank you so much.
Gosh.
Thank you. Thank you, committee. With that, we close the work session on House Bill 3332 and open up the first public hearing on House Bill 3217.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3217 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but the statement has not yet been issued. It expands the definition of the abuse of individuals with mental illness and recognizes responsibility of Oregon Health Authority to investigate abuse of individuals with mental illness.
We have no one here to testify. This came, yes.
I can give some background on this.
Okay. Great. Go ahead.
So this bill, as you know, abuse is something that we talk a lot about in the legislature. And with all of the work that different groups had done around abuse, the Legislative Council was in the position of needing to make some negative rule determinations around abuse investigations for DHS and the Oregon Health Authority. So the Legislative Council had suggested a path forward of adjustments that we could make in statute to allow the department to adopt the rules that they would like to adopt. And this, without getting the negative determinations from the Legislative Council. And this bill represents a lot of conversations about how to get that exactly right. And in the pursuit of getting it exactly right, there will be one more amendment to the bill. But the idea is that it would kind of put into statute what is already the practice and not have any substantive change. And maybe there's someone here from the department that can describe
Leah that. Looks like she wants to speak.
Yes. I'm sure she loves this.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Leah Kraft. I'm the Government Affairs Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. We have worked quite a long time with Representative Gelser on this, and I appreciate your commitment to helping us through this. But we do have one amendment coming, I believe, that would, as a Representative Gelser indicated, codify our current practice related to how we are looking at the abuse investigations with individuals with mental illness based on the negative rule determinations that one of our offices has been receiving. So we'll continue to work on that language and hopefully have something that will be palatable very soon.
Thank you, Leah. Any questions? Thank you for coming to testify. I appreciate that. Anything further, Representative Gelser? Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3217. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2163 and carry it over. And we had talked about Fridays. It seems that one of our members finds it difficult to go until 5:30 on Mondays and Wednesdays. So what we're going to try to do is to fit in our bills on Mondays and Wednesdays. We will still plan on meeting on Fridays, but we'll try to make them short so that people can take off early on Friday. So that's what our intent is. It may not work out that way, but we'll try. So thank you very much. Have a great week. And with that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.